to end off our past 2 days' discussion. So I said two developments since yesterday. One is I saw some fascinating things in the Sefer Moedim Muzmanim, which I'd like to share with you. And also I had a discussion this morning with Mary Rabbi Rebbe Baruch Slaim Shlita, who I first heard talk about this topic probably 15 years ago, and discussed with him a little bit some of the things we spoke about, and I asked him if he felt anything else should be emphasized, other than the Heinetz Netzacham Encyclopedia Talmudist point, which of course is the most important point, but beyond that, anything else that should be emphasized. So just one point. First of all, I want to clarify in case this isn't clear. So basically, we know that beyond, we have Rabbeinu Tam and we have the Gra, but both of them have numerical systems that are not going to help us so much. Basically, we can't use either of their numbers, so we're left with Chush. But then what's the difference between the Chush for Rabbeinu Tam and the Chush for the Gra? So basically, just to sum up, again, this is hopefully you've come out, but just to make sure this is clear. So when we talk about the Gra, if we assume that we're passing like the Gra, so the Chush means, as we saw, but really expressed, it basically means three stars. And as Rabbi Willig pointed out, that for an issue of the Rabbanan, he could be makel three stars based on an expert's ascertaining the three stars, which will happen earlier. And for Din Rabbanan, could be three stars, I mean, for Din D'Oraisa, three stars that an average person sees a little bit later. So Rabbeinu Tam's Chush, apparently, Ben Blanazeh, strongly depends on that explanation that we used yesterday, the same explanation that Rav Druk has and others have, that, again, we questioned how does Rabbeinu Tam shtim with the Chush. And again, first ascertaining that even Rabbeinu Tam would acknowledge that when the Chush contradicts him, so he would bow to that, as Ramesh finally held and as the Bureau of Halacha held. So that point that we mentioned from the Oros Chaim, that perhaps what Rabbeinu Tam meant is that three stars in the western end of the horizon, which Taka takes longer, so that's a very important position to be aware of. And apparently, when we talk about Rabbeinu Tam Chush Bizmanazeh, somebody following the Rabbeinu Tam and using his Chush to figure out when that is, so that's basically what we're talking about. We're talking about three stars on the west. So, again, basically, the Gra is three stars, and Rabbeinu Tam is three stars, Davka, in that western end of the horizon. And as Simon mentioned, and this I half remembered from his original share, but that this is Alan Meltzer in his Haskama to the Sefer of Rav Druk's, gave him a big yeshikaya for this explanation of the Rabbeinu Tam, and said that it's a big toelis, because now people won't think that the Rabbeinu Tam sheet is a total joke, it doesn't match anything. He explains how it matches the Mitzvahs to some extent, and therefore that does a lot to restore people's understanding of this important sheet, and he thought that was very much the toelis. So that's what the Rabbi Simon wanted to add. In the Moedim Muzmanim, there's a very fascinating discussion, and I have to confess I don't totally follow everything that he's saying. He takes some things along a different direction. I just want to highlight some points. It's interesting to see a totally different perspective on this issue. So he, first of all, one thing he discusses this issue of Alaska and Antarctica that some people asked about yesterday, and places where you don't really have any nightfall. So he, this is Taka Asher situation, and he suggests that the day switches at whatever point it's closest to hitting night, whatever that is, and whatever the revolving of the earth makes it so that it's closest to approaching darkness, that's when the day is going to switch from one day to another. But as far as most halachas of night, it seems that there's not going to be a status of night during that time. And therefore, it's really not appropriate for a Jew to live there b'kviyas. For somebody to live there permanently, where they're going to be mevatel from themselves these halachas that are going to be relevant to them. So he thinks that would be
anything that refers to night.
Yeah. However, and here's also, this is especially relevant to our discussions, that it may be, and we don't have the kalim to figure this out, but it may be that this is going to be different when it comes to Kriya Shema. Because, you know, Kriya Shema is defined by Shiva. So normally we've been until now understanding that as a time within Laila. But here it might be the other direction, that if you have no darkness for weeks on end, so presumably people sleep at some time, so this Man Shiva may develop some type of definition outside of darkness. And that's a possibility, but again, you have to figure that out. He mentions that he saw in some svarim that suggests if you have no nighttime, that you just have to make up a 12 and 12 structure, 12 hours of daytime, 12 hours of nighttime. He thinks that's a very difficult metaphysical position isn't really based on anything, and how are we going to establish such very significant halachas based on something like that? So it seems more indicated that we don't really have a night time. We have a day passing at whatever point it is that's closest to it. We don't really have a halacha of night time. Perhaps we have a halacha of shiva. And since we don't have a halacha of night time, so therefore it's very schwer to live there and live without night. Hi. Well, it's not one long day. It's many days without nights. Right, that's the difference. The days switch, but they don't become night. So, hi.
Blake has an article about this. Mm-hmm. He says that.
Anybody has a Blake's form here?
He has a recent tradition.
It's probably reprinted in the books also. The recent tradition?
I think so.
Okay, go on.
So, he goes to Maskana there, that basically the entire concept of Zmanim is only given to place is Shayach to tell time. And if you're in these places doesn't have time, you're literally living outside of time, and
outside
therefore
time.
Really put there from all these misses of Zmanim.
It's like the same thing.
It's the Shabbat space.
It's like Eretz
Yisrael.
Exactly.
Yes, exactly.
You're
Potter
from
Shvi's
because you're
Eretz Yisrael. Sounds good to me. Another point that Rav Schoenbuch raises, and this is where it really gets different. So Rav Schoenbuch discusses Rabbi Natan's mind, which he considers to be, again, a very serious idea. And he says, maybe if you're somebody who always does everything by the grass, that's one thing, but for everyone else, he thinks the time thing is a very serious thing to take into consideration. And again, you see, Mitzias wise, his understanding is very different than the understanding that Moshe had, or that especially the Rebbe Willock had. In his perception, basically, the 72-minute practice is prevalent throughout the world, and he's also assuming that a mil is 18 minutes. That's the way it is, and that's sure the case. And therefore, Ben Tamzman is 72 minutes, and it's 72 minutes throughout the world. And then Yikitaka ask, so why is it that this doesn't shift from place to place? And clearly, since places are at different points along the globe, the minutes, the timing should be different. And in his perception, it's not the case that it's observed differently. So why is that? So he suggests that a very machodesh approach. That basically Rabbeinu Tam's position is that the shear of night is three stars at whatever visibility exists 72 minutes after the shear. So in other words, that will mean one level of visibility in Eretz Yisrael, and a different level of visibility in London, and a different level of visibility in Los Angeles. Wherever you are, 72 minutes in, and visibility of stars, that's the shear. It's a very machodesh position. It does remind one of the chakira we mentioned last, and we mentioned in the previous discussions, that Rabbi Chanan has a chakira in the beginning of his Sefer Pesachim about this whole idea of three stars being night. So is it that the three stars are a simon that it's night, that really it's night by itself, and the three stars are telling us that it's night? Or is it that the three stars themselves establish night? Which seems a less likely possibility. Bachan has an afkamina there. As far as Aegis is concerned, it seems a less likely possibility, but on the other hand, it seems like that's what Rav Schoenbuch is saying here, that really it is the stars. And Rabbeinu Tam is telling us that whatever visibility of the stars we have at 72 minutes, at whatever point in the world you are, that's what the shear is. And it's very mechudish, but that seems to be what he's saying. Also on this whole simon idea, this is the story that Rabbi Simon mentioned in this conversation also. It doesn't necessarily have so much halachic significance, but you're probably mostly too young to remember that we used to have a bochen in the yeshiva by the name of Shraga Feivel Peretsky, Peretsky was a Talmud in Radin, and Peretsky reported that when he was by the Chafetz Chaim, and he would go to the Chafetz Chaim's house on Shabbos, so they would have Shal Shudas, and they would have whatever was going on. And then, as it got dark, so the Chafetz Chaim would send somebody outside to go look if there were three stars. If there were three stars, then they would make Havdal. And sometimes they would schlep on a little more, with singing, and it would go for a long time, wherever it is, the Torah, whatever it was they were doing. And the Chafetz Chaim would say, it's okay, you don't have to go, I'm sure by now it's three stars out there. I'm not necessarily sure whether this has so much significance, but just that was the way they were operating in Radin at the time. David.
In each place, the amount of darkness you need is going
going to vary based on it, yeah.
And, but what about times of year? Is it also going to be days?
Oh, so then, right, so then he says that times of year doesn't really change. We don't necessarily make it zmanias. But, thank you for reminding me, he does say for the summer it should be a little longer. He has a very vague standard. He says it's not really going to shift significantly throughout the year, except that the summer, the days are longer, a little bit more. That's basically how he puts it. It's basically a standard 72 minutes and a little more in the summer. So basically, to sum up, in the different relationships to the 72-minute question, so is there any significance to 72 minutes? How do we relate to that? So we saw different perspectives, that according to Rav Sternberg, 72 minutes is significant, and that's right, and it's so significant that that's the indicator no matter what's going on in the sky, basically. According to Rabbi Willig, 72 minutes has no significance at all, because it's combining contradictory shittas, or it's combining shittas that are not held by any one person, because Rabbeinu Tam is the 4-mil shita, and 4 mil is how you get 72 minutes, except that Rabbeinu Tam would not acknowledge an 18-minute mil, he would hold for a 22.5-minute mil, so if you want to hold Rabbeinu Tam, you have to have, let's say, 90 minutes, or whatever it's going to be. So therefore, basically, the 72-minute shita has no kiyum, according to Rabbeinu Willig, because it's not really, doesn't really follow anybody, and therefore the more extreme numbers you come up with, if you really follow Rabbeinu Tam or not practice, then that's a raya that basically Rabbeinu Tam is not the halacha l'maisa. And Rabbi Moshe's perspective is that Rabbeinu Tam's position is really affected by the chush, so therefore, practically speaking, as Rabbi Moshe puts it, in most cities in America, it's a 50-minute shir, and that's really enough for Rabbeinu Tam, but 72 minutes, since there is a prevalent practice to do 72 minutes, he recommends it as a chumrah, even though he knows that it has inconsistencies and it has aspects of it that are not totally logical, but he's not worried about it because he thinks maker a din, Rabbeinu Tam's mind is already done. So the 72 minutes is recommending the chumrah, but the fact that it has whatever logical issues with it is not a problem because he doesn't really think that's the maker a din, Rabbeinu Tam. Right? Like Rav Sternbuch is saying.
That's basically
Rav Sternbuch's perspective. The fact is, he was looking at the world and he's seeing 72 minutes all over the place. I mean, you see a little bit of a different perspective here. It's kind of fascinating to observe. But basically, that's what Rav Sternbuch is saying, that since we look around the world and we see 72 minutes, so we can see from here that that is Rabbeinu Tam's one, and he's not even getting into the whole mill thing because he really seems convinced the mill is 18 minutes. So he doesn't have the same. But Willick has a whole mahalach to establish that according to Rabbeinu Tam, it's 22 and a half. Shemrach doesn't really get into that much more than to tell you that he's pretty sure it's 18 minutes. And therefore, working from that, he believes it is 72 minutes always, and that's what the whole world does, the way he sees it, and that's what we have to figure out. He also has a little passage there also that he feels the practices before the Holocaust, things like that, whatever may have happened then, are not really of such significance because when people were dispersed, after that point, then communities were reformed, so now there are new minhagim, and we can't really say that the practices that were done before, even if they're practices lakula. And he goes so far as to say, yes, that person who was a shomer shabbos then doing the same practices now or a machal shabbos. Take that what you will, but that's the way he understands it. Anyway, a fascinating piece. If you'd like to take a look, it's in the Mo'ed Mishmanim. He has two essays about it, one in Chilik Beis and one in Chilik Zayin. If you want more precise references, I'll be glad to provide them. Okay, so fine. I've kind for now. That's fine. I reserve the right to revisit it from time to time. But that's what I wanted to add to discussion of the past 2 days. Okay, so now just again to look at some selected passages from Gimel and Dalet, and just observe how some of them may have made a difference in different halachic discussions. So David's very concerned about counting mishmaros, and why do we care? The whole discussion, 3 mishmaros, 4 mishmaros, so what nafkamin does it have? Of course, this is a Gemara on Nav Gimel. And Nav Gimel Maralev. It's an Inayim L'Mishpat, which is a beautiful sefer, which I recommend to everyone on the Masechtas that it talks about, including Brachas. So he says, first of all, it's nafkamin for the Beit HaMikdash. But the Tiferes Yisrael, the beginning of Talmud, says that it's a reference to mishmaros ba'ara, mishmaros in the world, is a reference to mishmaros in the Beit HaMikdash, and therefore it follows the pattern of our Gemara. And the Meiri says, Nafkamina for Nidarim. Right? The person takes a nether to, but a little differently than we normally say. Not that a person takes a nether that he's going to you know, a person takes a shvuah, they're going to do this if it's four mishmaros or if it's three mishmaros. He said, a person takes a nether, he's going to learn until the first Ashmura, until the second Ashmura, so we have to know when the Ashmuras are. Or maybe for Mamanus, somebody may rent out his time, he may hire himself out as an employee until one Ashmura or the other, so we have to know. We have to know when the Ashmuras are. And then there's another aspect of Mishmaros that plays a role, but that's on Gimel Mibay, so we'll get to that in a few minutes. Okay, so that's one point that comes out of here, this significance of counting Mishmaros. Also, the Rishonim quote a minig to cry over the Beis HaMikdash at the end of every Ashmara, and that's discussed in the Rush and in the Torah, and that's a little different than, I'll say, our practice, but the practice of those who have practiced Tikkun Chatzos, so we normally associate that with Chatzos, so how does this shtim with the idea of every Ashmura? Chatzos isn't even one of the Ashmuras, Chatzos is in the middle of one of the Ashmuras. That's a discussion in Svarim, if you want to take a look, if Yonis and Eifshitz has the sefer that came out relatively recently, in the past 10-15 years, called Kedusha Ben Yehonasan, on Brachas, where he puts together manuscripts that Yonis and Eifshitz has on Brachas. He has a little bit of discussion how to work that out with the practice of Tikkun Chatzos, which is brought in the first in the Shulchan Aruch and the Mishnah Berurah. That practice that's Rishonim quote in association with Mishmaros, which are not of Chatzos. So he has a little discussion how to reconcile that. The Gemara on the bottom of Gimel Meralef, the whole story about the Churba. So first of all, it's a song, right? So that's important after me. But besides that, so I remember Rabbi Yitzchak Cohen commented once on the song that we should put the entire Shasta music in and people will remember. So that's significant. But besides that, so this affects, this sugya affects how we relate to Kaddish. Right? The story tells us that at the end, so this whole story took place in the Churba, so we look in the bottom of Gimel Mar Aleph, so we see this statement about what a Kaddish Baruch Hu does, and then the Gemara says that Bishashi Yisrael Nechnas Nabati Knesius Nabati Midrashos Va'onin Yehei Shmei HaGadol Mivarach. At that time, so Kaddish Baruch Hu was very impressed, and Kaddish Baruch Hu Maneh Rosho, and he says V'Ashrei Melech Shemakalso V'Bezo, etc., etc. It's all a wonderful thing. It's very effective when the Jews go into shul and they say the sentence which the Gemara has, Yehei Shmei HaGadol Mivarach. So this line, of course, sounds familiar from the middle of Kaddish, and apparently it is relevant to the paragraph we have in Kaddish. And if you look at this Tosos on Gimel Mar Aleph and Dibra Maschel V'Onin, this last Tosos on Gimel Mar Aleph, so you see a couple of interesting points, just as far as how we relate to the meaning of the words in Kaddish. So Tosos says this is a rally against the Machzor of Vitri. The Machzor of Vitri understands that Yehei Shmei Rabba, what does that mean? That's a tefillah she'anu mispalin she'yimale shmo, that we want that his name should be big. Yehei Shmo, his name should be big. As the pasuk says, ki adal keiska shelo yehei shmo shalom v'kiso shalom ad she'im chazar shalom malik. So basically, we're praying for this to happen, that God says his name is not going to be complete until the malik is destroyed. So therefore, we're advocating that, and that's what we're saying. Perusho kach yehei shmei, shmei shin mem yud, and then a hey, that's the way of saying shame ka. So that yehei shmei, rabba, his name should be great. Kolay marashan mispalam shehei shmei gadol v'shalom. That we're praying that his name should be great and complete. And umavarach la'olam, that rest of it is, that's not tefillah acheres, that's another tefillah. We also want that it should be blessed forever. So yehei shmei rabba, umavarach la'olam. And Tosfos disagrees. Says, this does not make sense to me. That we see here, that he says, yehei shmei ha'gadol mivarach. The text that Tosfos has in our Gemara is that, presuming it's already gadol. It's not saying yehei shmei rabba, but rather, Yehei Shmo HaRabba, his already Shem HaGadol, his already his big name, should be Mevorach. So, Mashma Tefillah Achasi, that apparently this is one Tefillah. The Eina Rotz Lomar Shehei Shmo Gadol V'Shalom, Ela Yehei Shmo HaGadol Mevorach. Right, so it's not that we're saying two Tefillahs, the first that his name should be great, and his name should be complete, and then also that it should be eternally blessed, but this is one sentence, that his great name should be eternally blessed. So that's one point of dispute between the Machzor of Vitri and Tosfos, which impacts how you pronounce the words, impacts where you stop. Do we say Yehei Shmei Rabba, Yehei Shmei Rabba, Mevorach Le'olam, or do we say Yehei Shmei Rabba, Mevorach Le'olam? And this is 2 days in Shulchan Aruch, and this is discussed in the poskim, and this is something that comes out of this text. And then Tosfos then goes on to discuss the question of why it is that we say it in Aramaic. This idea of Wav Kaddish being recited in Aramaic. So first Tosfos quotes an idea that it's a reflection of the fact that this is a very special, wonderful prayer, and we think it's such a gavaldik tefillah, as the Gemara is emphasizing how wonderful it is, so this may get the angels jealous. And we know the angels, they don't understand Aramaic, so therefore they won't realize what's going on. It sounds like from other passages in Chazal, this is a serious concern. And we know that the Malachim were upset that we were given the Torah, and they're upset at certain appearances of favoritism that the Kadosh Baruch Hu has for the Jewish people. So we see if the Gemara tells us that when we say Yehi Shmei Rav Mevarach, Kadosh Baruch Hu is so impressed, the Kadosh Baruch Hu thinks it's the most gavaldik thing. So it's kind of understandable. Al pi midas, we don't want to get the Malachim jealous. But Tosfos says it's not really the reason. And really, the reason is that this is associated with Talmud Torah, that the Kadosh would be recited, as we have a practice today as well, Kadosh Drabanan, after some public shiurim. So since the masses were present, and the vernacular was Aramaic, so therefore Kaddish, in order to be appropriate for that form, was instituted in Aramaic. So that's the real reason why this is all in Aramaic. Hi?
The Gemara says, is that what they were saying, or is that just why the Gemara is in Galo?
As opposed to Aramaic. Right, so I think that's what Tosfos is addressing. There are practice to take this phrase and put it into Aramaic. Well, that's not according to the Machzav Itri. According to the Machzav Itri, it's shame, Hashem. Right, according to Tosfos, it is Aramaic. So. Unless it's a Girsa question. Tosfos is different. Yeah. Right, according to the Machzav Itri, it's shame, Hashem. And according to Tosfos, they'll change it to Shema. But our practice
has Shmei, no?
Our Gemara has Shmei, but that's the Girsa question.
Isn't
Tosfos Girsa Shmei, though? The Tosfos Machzavitri is Girsa Shmei. And you see on the side, it says Girsa Marisho Shmo.
Even in Tosfos?
I think so. But it doesn't matter, because practically speaking, the same Gavasli, the way we say the Mice and Aramaic is Jesus, but what does it mean? So it means, according to Machzavitri, that his name should be big, but according to Tosfos, no, that he's name is big already, and the whole thing should be black. So another issue that affects how we pronounce this is also very lemaisa, perhaps even a little more lemaisa, is so the Gemara says this in Shabbos and Kufis has in the base that this phrase v'ameni heishmei rabba, that whoever says it v'kol koicho, so that has the effect of undoing all the gezeiros against him. So what does that mean? So Rabbeinu Yonah in Brachos, Rabbeinu Yonah understands that basically the purpose is that you need to get your kavana up. This is something very significant, so we need to raise your kavana. So it doesn't mean that you have to scream it for anybody else's sake, and Poskim emphasize that you shouldn't do something that people are going to think ridiculous. You shouldn't go do it to the point where people are going to be laughing at you. But the idea is to do what's going to be effective for your kavana. However, the Beis Yosef quotes from the Zohar that there's a more mystical idea that by doing it loud, you break up the destructive forces. It's your weapon of your sonic boom against these bad forces. So basically, this idea of kol kocho, there's a difference between Rabbeinu Yonah and the Beis Yosef quoting the Zohar. The Rabbeinu Yonah says the function of kavana, and the Zohar and the Beis Yosef give it this mystical significance that it's a way of destroying the enemies. So in the Shulchan Aruch, it quotes Kol Ram. And the Magen Avraham, in commenting on this, quotes Rabbeinu Yonah. And the Shaar Mesuganim B'Halacha, and I'll just talk about this, it's a little difficult, because the Rabbeinu Yonah has a different understanding than the Beis Yosef does. So why the Magen Avraham is quoting the Magen Avraham to explain the Shulchan Aruch is a little unclear.
Why the Magen Avraham is
quoting Rabbeinu Yonah? Yeah. The Beis Yosef brings another point in relation to this, which again is very relevant to our practice, that the Beis Yosef says that Kol Kocho, Koach, is a remez to 28 letters, which means that you should only say up to Olmaya, and not with Yisbara. However, the Beis Yosef himself argues on this and quotes in Midrashim that it's not appropriate to put Al Pi HaDerech HaSod, that it's not right to stop in between Mayim and Yisbarach, and that's how he passes in Shulchan Aruch, that you should say Yishmer Mevarach and Mayim Yisbarach.
You should say it all the way to
Yisbarach. All the way to Yisbarach. No, to the word Yisbarach.
What's the practice of starting to say it all the way to Yisbarach?
that is that the Shacharar is talking, I think, about the word Yisbarach. So in the Bir Hagra, he disagrees, Bir Hagra over there in Sifkot and Tess, and he says that the answer should only go up to Omaya, don't say Yisbarach. But the Aruch HaShulchan writes that the Minig HaOlam, and you can decide what your own Minig is, but the Minig Rav HaOlam, the way Aruch HaShulchan understands it, is to say like the Beis Yosef, and that's the Minig, to go up to Yisbarach. Separate and still say. Okay. Sounds good. Just another community in the Sefer Sharm Tzion B'Halacha has a lot of nice Haaretz in general. So he has a nice little discussion over here. That so this next line, right after it says that when we say Heishmer Abba Mevarach, so it says the Kodesh Baruch Hu Menaneh Rosho. So if you look in the Sharm Tzion B'Halacha, you see a nice little discussion about the status of nodding in Halacha. This is the Kodesh Baruch Hu's way of showing his haskama, and this is something you find in Halacha, as Rashi explains in Halus and Gimel, that Hirkin Rosho, so Rashi says that shows that you made down what's being said, and there are other Rashi's like that in Nida and in Gittin, and Tosis writes in Kedushin and Daf Ayin Chesem and Beis, that if you have somebody who's sick and who's not able to talk, and you suggest, you know, you want your property to be divided this way or that way, and he nods, so that can have enough gemini lalacha, that can be something that's effective. And the Shvas Yankov and his Chuvus writes also that if you wanna be mashpia, somebody, you wanna make somebody else take a shvua, and the person happens to be mute, he's not capable of speaking. So, but if he can nod at what you're saying, so that's also going to be effective. And the Chasam Sofer then goes on to say in his Chuvus and Ebenezer and Chelik Aleph and Samin Amdala that this is not only nodding, if he points, if he does whatever, the point is if he gestures with his fingers, so that's also significant. That has nafkaminas l'chumra as well. Again, to bring it back to Hilchos Kriyas Shema, something that's brought in the poskim that when we say that it's not appropriate to communicate during, like very inappropriate to communicate during Kriyas Shema, you're not supposed to be talking during Kriyas Shema. So we see that nodding and indicating and using your fingers and all of that is also considered to be halachic communication. So that's also an appropriate interpretation. This is something that most people are not aware of. I think most people are make a line, but I think in the Sfarim it says this is not something that's not part of the Sharm Tzion B'Halacha discussion. I think that in the Sfarim it says you have to be machmir in that. You have to assume that if you're gesturing with your hands or with your nodding and doing various types of communication, that that's also an appropriate interpretation, just as verbal communication is, which is something that people are have a difficult time with. Have you finished? Okay, who's up first?
So,
I don't know if it's a hefsek we kuva, but it's definitely written in Svarim that you shouldn't do it. Whether they would say, like, you've messed up your fish or not, I'm not sure.
That's like if you say you said emotionally.
Well, even if you say, even at that, well, I think Pashto is not. There is a big Svar to say differently than this. I mean, it's just against what it says in Svarim. Right? There is a Svar to say that the whole point of not being mafsik is because you have to maintain the connection between the bracha and what's going on now. So if I'm gesticulating wildly because I can't talk, so that is a way of keeping up the connection. The fact is, if I had not watched, I would just talk. And because I watched, I'm making all kinds of hand signals, or because I'm in the middle of whatever it is. So one could have argued that that is effective in maintaining me. I'm not going to forget what I'm doing if I'm so inconvenient in the way I'm communicating, that's a way of maintaining the consciousness. But nonetheless, it's not supported by the Svarim.
You said it also refers to a shvua. Does that, to what extent does that go?
Well, the first Mishnah in the Darim talks about being mushba yidei acher.
Right.
So there are nafkaminas for mushba pi atzmo, mushba mipi acher, which is a big run, the whole discussion in the base in the Darim, whatever that is, it's not a topic now. But the status of mushba pi acher in the saying can be accomplished through this nodding.
Even without, let's say,
shvuz edus? Hashus. Yeah, there's a little bit of discussion about edus in the Sharm Tzion B'Halacha.
Wait, not just for edus, but for, let's say, the person also does that, and so he doesn't know edus, and then. And he could have given Aedus another one from the guys. He had a
corner. No. Worth looking into. So this, on the next half, just bring back to David's favorite topic of Mishmaros. So here's another topic you may have thought doesn't have much nafkamino lahalacha. But, so the Gemara talks about whether there's four Mishmaros and, or three Mishmaros. And the Gemara asks, well, it's gotta be four because halfway through the night there was a reference to Mishmaros. And if there's only three, so then there's only been a mishmar and a half so far. So Gemara says, no, Mishmara Palga can also be called a Mishmara. One and a half Mishmara can also be called Mishmaros. One and a half Mishmara can also be called two Mishmaros. So this is something Posim quote also. The Chulas Marasham has a discussion about sometimes when you need plurals in Halacha, that one and a half can count. And again, the Shaar Metzion Halacha has a nice aura on this point. It refers you to the Chulas Chasim Sofer. And our Chaim is in Mem Vav, with quotes from the Minchas Yaakov. That based on this Gemara, he says that on Shabbos you want to have Lacha Mishnah. So if you have a roll and a half, that's also called two. And we see from our Gemara that one and a half Mishmaros is called two Mishmaros. So too, one and a half Chalas is called two Chalas. So the Shaar Metzion Halacha himself thought there's a Raya Beferish against that, because the Gemara later on, about one test in the base, says that in Pesach, so you can, the Gemara says that everyone agrees that on Pesach you can have one and a half matzahs because of Lechemoni, and the Gemara distinguishes that from Shabbos, so it seems to be the Farish against what the Sfenchus Yaakov is saying. The Gemara is pretty explicit with the difference between Pesach and Shabbos. And the Netziv, in his Chuvas, so the Netziv has an Arichus to prove that if you don't have full Chalas, so you can take incomplete Chalas, and that's also called Racha Mishnah, and the Aruch HaShulchan has a similar point. And he brings a riot from the fact that Poskim say that you can be Yotzei Lacha Mishnah with one and a half matzahs or with one and a half chalas. But, as the Shaar Metzion Halacha points out, that according if the riot is from this Gemara, so it's not necessarily true, because our Gemara tells us that one and a half is like two. It doesn't mean that any half is like a whole. So if you can have two halves, that doesn't necessarily count as two wholes. It means one and a half is two. The Gemara also has a discussion, as you remember, in relation to this. So we know that there certainly is a preference for a complete chalas. And as you recall, many years ago, Rabbi Shechter Shlita came to visit Moresh HaKolo around this time of year. And I think the high school kolo was learning brachas at the time, so he gave a shiur to the high school kolo. And he was talking about Lacha Mishnah. And he mentioned the story that Rabbi Shaul Salanter, when he was involved in starting up the Musar movement, so there was a lot of opposition, and many yeshivas felt it was a waste of time to spend so much attention on developing character and midos and working with that type of focus as opposed to just going through Shastray. And they would say to Rabbi Shaul Salanter, you know, why are you wasting the Talmidim's time? They could become much bigger gedolim if you would just leave them alone and let them learn. They could become much bigger gedolim. So Rabbi Shaul Salanter would point to the halachas of Lacha Mishnah. And Lacha Mishnah, so we see the preference for shleimus over gadlus. If you have a choice between a whole roll or a big piece of bread, that's not complete. So we prefer the small whole roll. So we follow shleimus. We're looking for shleimus in life. We're not looking for gadlus. So that was how Rabbi Shaul Salanter would respond. Hi.
What?
Mm-hmm. Oh, the Mesh Dagger.
So, unless you never saw. Part of that, what would happen if you had like one whole roll? Better break it in half than two halves.
You could come to that conclusion, but again, it's a shadow whether anyone accepts this. But within that way of thinking, I guess you could make it, you could say as far to say that the halacha of Mishnah is more important than. The halacha of whole is not like, if you're saying like that, then one could say that Mishnah is more important, better to have lacha Mishnah and not have holes. And you could follow the technique to that extent, but I don't know if it's accepted in practice. Hi.
How's the answer to
it means it's plural. Anything more than one is plural. Even if it's not all the way at two. And so Allah says you need two. Reasonable point. Reasonable point. Okay, so moving on a little bit. So then the Gemara tells us about David HaMelech. This whole story with David and his tefillos. And one of the things that David says is that he's very proud of himself. He's a chassid. He's involved in Halach L'maisa. And if you're familiar with Halachic Man, if you've read the Rav's work, Halachic Man, you see this passage that the when David proudly proclaims his involvement in the realities of Halacha L'maisa and claims credit for that, that's very much an aspect of a halachic personality. And David says, "Ani yodaim luchlochais b'dam my hands are wet, so if my hands are dirty with blood, but I'm involved in answering Hilchos Nidashayla, I'm involved in looking at Maris, and that's a tremendous thing. So again, philosophically, this is something that the Rav deals with at length in Halachic Man. But from a Halachic perspective, so the Bach writes in Yerodei, and it's in the Kuf Peches, that he thinks that it should be appropriate that somebody who's looking at a Maris, somebody who's looking at something with blood on it, shouldn't look at it when it's wet. Rather, we should wait till it dries off, because maybe something will change. And the Shach and the Taz disagree, and they say this is not the practice at all, and we're not chayshah to this, and the Chacham Tzvi said like this also. And some Svarim, they bring a Raya from here, that we see that David HaMelech said his hands were wet, that his hands were got dirty from touching these Maris, so apparently he's looking at them when they're still wet, so that's a Raya against the Bach. And this is brought a number of the Svarim that discuss the halachic points in the Skamar and the Nairo Mishpat and the Shar Mitzvah Balach. A lot of Svarim make reference to this Bach in relationship to this Skamar. So the Placey, the Ravenus and Ipshis from the Placey, says this is not really such a good riot. That it could be that David Melech was different. That in those days there was such a bikini they could even tell by the smell. So he doesn't have to really care whether it's wet or dry. Maybe it was Maneinu, maybe it was a different standard.
Is there a source for that?
He may have sources to look where he comes from, and maybe I get the impression that there is. And in the Arugas Habosan and his Hakdama that his son wrote actually. Do you want to ask him? In the Arugas Habosan's Hakdama from the son, so he comments that the Gemara says later on in Brachas and Samach Gimel in the days. That Kol Talmud Shekoyes Olov Rabo V'Shosek. If your Rebbe gets mad at you when you're quiet, so your Zoichel Lahavken Bein Dam Talmud Latar. So you have a special source. So you're able to tell the difference between Dam that Asers and Dam that doesn't. And so based on that, we can understand how David HaMelech was able to paskin with a situation that was getting his hands dirty with a Maris that was still wet. It's against the Bach. So it says you have to say that David had a special Bekiyas in Dan, that he didn't have to worry about the Schumer or the Bach. And how did he get the special Bekiyas? Because of the whole story here with Mephibosheth, that he was quiet, and Mephibosheth embarrassed him, and he's able to take it quietly, so therefore he has this schus. The Gemara says you're able to tell the difference between Dan Tome and Dan Tar, and therefore he's not a Raya, the rest of the world can't follow his practices, and he is able to tell the difference between Dan Tome and Dan Tar. Even if it's wet. Okay, so that takes us to Dalet Amud Beis. Okay, so Dalet Amud Beis, I don't have a Rambam. Oh, is my room nearby? Maybe you can you call up Mamrim Beis Beis?
Yeah, sure.
Okay, so here's Gemara makes more reference to this Siag idea. And we already spoke about this. We're not going to say so much more about it. We'll just add a word or two about it. That, on the one hand, so, first of all, just to deal with our phrase here at the end, the Gemara has a very scary kind of idea that kola overal divrei sofrim chayiv misa, that if you violate the words of Chazal, then chayiv misa. That sounds like a very scary thought. And it is. But Chavis Yar writes in his Shuvis about this and other things that it's a little bit less scary. It doesn't mean if you do it once, it's referring to people who do these kind of things all the time. And if you do these things all the time, so you're Chayiv Misa. I thought it's not necessarily fit with this context, but this may be relevant to the, especially in the kind of Gemara is talking about somebody who violates the Rabbanim, who violates the Rechachamim. So as you're familiar, there is a dispute between the Rambam and the Ramban as far as how all Dinim the Rabbanim are sourced, that according to the Rambam, this is not what I'm asking you to call up. That's not what I'm asking you to call up. It's a different
thing. I know. But I have. I'm going to be ready.
Got it. So according to the Rambam, the Pasuk of Loisosrim and Hadavar is the source for all Dinam Drabbanan, that the Torah tells you that if you don't know what's going on in something, so you're supposed to go to the Chacham at that time, he's going to tell you what to do, and you're not supposed to deviate Loisosrim and Hadavar. You can't deviate from what they tell you. So the Rambam says that's the marker that the Chazal can make up can make up new mitzvahs. And the Ramban disagrees, and the Ramban says, no, this only means that you have to listen to when they tell you what the Pesukim and the Torah mean. But the ability to make up new dinim, that comes from somewhere else, and it's a whole discussion to figure out where it comes from. So, the Achronim and the Falco, what exactly is the position of the Rambam, what exactly is the position of the Ramban? You have theories sometimes, you have people who interpret the Rambam, so basically it comes out the same way as the Ramban, and vice versa. But there are some who suggest, whether according to one or the other, and I'm telescoping this discussion tremendously, it's really an hour-long discussion, just saying in 2 minutes, but there are some who suggest that the Torah tells you, Lo Sasser, that means that you have to listen to Chazal, but that means, like the Meshech Chachma writes, it means in an umbrella sense, that you have to submit to the authority of the rabbis as a whole. And that doesn't mean that it's specifically every din d'rabbanan that you violate is going to be an Isser d'oraisa. This is an important point, because Ramban asks on the Rambam, if the Rambam is right, so then how can we say something d'rabbanan l'kulo, for example? How can we ever distinguish in practice between a din d'rabbanan and a din d'oraisa? Every din d'rabbanan is a din d'oraisa. Torah tells us, it's not only din d'oraisa, it's an Isser d'oraisa. Right? Torah says, don't deviate from Chazal, so it's an Isser d'oraisa, which enforces every single din d'rabbanan. So how do you ever differentiate? So you have to say, one of the approaches, there are a number of approaches, one approach that people say is that, no, the Ram doesn't mean to say that. The Ram doesn't mean to say that every Yisra D'Rabbanan takes on a tzuruv of an Yisra D'Raisa. But rather, an Yisra D'Rabbanan, that the Torah tells us we have to listen to Chazal. And if we rebel against Chazal, so as we discussed a few last week from the Nesivis, in a different format, if you rebel against Chazal, so then that's a violation of Leis Aser. But the fact that you're doing a Issa Drabbanan in an isolated case, or for short taiva or accident or whatever it is, that's not necessarily per se a violation of Leis Aser. So one could suggest also that that's what the Gemara is saying, that the way the Chavis Yar emphasizes, even though he's maybe saying this about other things as well, but to borrow the sentence from the Chavis Yar, that this is only talking about somebody who does this all the time. So within this context, that could make more sense, because since the Yisurim Drabbanan do not necessarily have this independent status that Yisurim D'Raisa have, at least according to this interpretation, but rather it's someone who denies the power of Chazal to have authority over him, that's when you violate Leis Aser. So that's what the Gemara is saying. If someone says, I'm regularly always going to violate Din D'Rabbanan because I don't think they have any relevance to me, so then he's basically undermining the power of Chazal to address him. So that's an Issa D'Raisa of Leis Aser. If somebody once, twice, whatever, an isolated incident, violates Issa D'Rabbanan, that does not necessarily make any statement about his acceptance of the principle of Leis Aser, and that may, at least the way some Achronim understand, not be a violation of Leis Aser, even according to the Rambam. Okay, we said that very quickly. Everyone follow that more or less? Sorry? I put together a few things. The Chavis Yar was interpreting this Gemara as saying that this is only someone who does it regularly. And we're saying that one could say, that if you say this Gemara is only talking about doing it regularly, it's because since Achronim say that Leis Aser is not always violated when you do an Issa D'Rabbanan, but only when you do it in a way that rebels against the Koach of Chazal, so maybe doing it regularly, in our case, is rebelling against the Koach of Chazal. But doing it once does not necessarily mean that you... Sorry? The latter part of arguing against doing something regularly, I think the story is true before such a thing. Is there any enough room to find such an interpretation? Okay, so, sorry? Well, I think maybe we're about out of time. So tomorrow, basically, look at this Rambam. There's a couple of points that we can discuss tomorrow. That just one other point about the Siag thing, that if you look at this Rambam, Hilchos Mamrim, Perek Beis, Halacha Beis, and Halacha Gimel, so you see a difference between a Siag and a Gzeira.
Which is unclear what that difference is, but the Mishnah Ben. Look there as well, if you like.
But Rabbi Zalman feels that this Gemara might be the key to understanding that difference.